every nation know. Whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
I respected his tone. That man sounded sincere. So when the local draft board called, I went. It was the law. My dad said it was my decision.
Joe?
Beth and I sat for hours in deep, loving silence, in an eternal embrace. When I asked her, she too said, it was my decision. I flew out to Fort Lewis for NAM that July in 69. My parents and Beth had said their goodbyes. They didn't need to come and see me off. Lots of guys on the flight over the Pacific talked tough and crude and cut jokes. It helped cut the fear we felt. I was frozen in time. I wondered about killing and dying. I wanted to know. I was curious. I wanted to go to Vietnam to serve my country. I didn't hear anyone say I should do otherwise. When we finally landed, my life as a young man in the USA seemed suddenly to be lost.
Morning, Vietnam.
A blast of hot air and dust hit my face. I smelled diesel and the black tar of Cam Ranh Bay airstrip. Hot weather, always. In Vietnam, there are two seasons. Hot, or hot, sticky, and wet, enough to make leather rot, and too hot for underwear. In our full-pack gear, we looked, beside the Vietnamese, like huge gods. They were small, harmless, gentle. They called us the beautiful people. We were warned in basic training that little children sometimes carried live grenades in baskets. Number one GI meant you were the best. Vietnam in those very first days filled me with haunting wonder. John B., a guy from California, and I were lifted out by chopper, taking us two cherries to the 1st Cavalry Division near Tay Ninh, 3 Corps. Lucky us, infantry, front lines. John B. was quiet. He seemed to still be thinking a lot about what an old guy in California said. Don't fight for your country. God is your personal savior. The country below was fairy tale green. The jungle canopy sheltered all things ancient, menacing. Lizards, cobras, red ants. Sickness, jungle rot. We saw rice fields, but no one was hoeing them. There was a sorrow in the land. We were now over a free fire zone where any Vietnamese still around were considered the enemy. All the villagers in that area had already taken what belongings they could carry, and were marched to safer strategic hamlets. The B-52s then came in and bombed their ancestral homes into black, smoky ruins. We saw the form of an old peasant man reaching down and putting things in his basket, stooped in the center of a water-filled bomb crater where his centuries-old village had been. His face, from a distance, seemed weary but determined. He had decided to stay behind and soon join the spirits of his ancestors. The chopper descended into the sunlit clearing, surrounded by dense vegetation. The tiny figures below were GIs waiting for the mail, holding out letters for the door gunner to take back to the world. These were the men we would come to know, better than anyone in our lives, before or since. The men looked at us hard. They were quiet. Someone told me they had just walked into an ambush before we came. There was emptiness at this place. Someone was not there and missed. We traded cigarettes for pork slices, pear slices, fruit cocktail, or just tried to deal with the ham and mothers. Their stares were hard and looked deeply into my soul. "Who are you?" one said. They wanted to know if I could carry their ammo, cover their back, keep them alive, or get me and them killed like some stupid suck. The two tour guys listened to my responses in silence. They knew only time would tell. We humped through jungle so thick the sun didn't penetrate. Red ants bit my sweaty neck. In the humid heat, leeches hooked onto my skin and crotch when I scrubbed in a stream or got used to sleeping half-submerged in swamp water. My body just adjusted to the mosquitoes, and the bites stopped raising welts on my skin. We cleaned our fatigues in monsoon rain, oiled our weapons against too much dampness. Under a poncho, I wrote my parents and Beth letters. I never knew I could miss home and the world so much. I was counting down days to being there again. Chow time was when we joked. I remember Benson, so serious about his green cans with his P-38. Pork slices opened, mixing in hot sauce and onion. Hunched over, eating like a starving man just given a prime rib and baked potatoes. He didn't mind smoking the pell-mells that everybody traded him. His index finger was yellow. A big country boy with strong back, kinky hair, and pock-marked skin. He was always messing and jiving. We found some flyers dropped in the bush from a plane, telling American black men to stop fighting the yellow man. he kept to himself for a while after that. Our RTO, or radio man, was the Duke, 'cause his real name was Earl, had a bad family, and seemed sort of broken up when he got here. He made that radio pack his pride and joy, packing it to 60 pounds and humping that mother for us for days on end through the bush. So we called him Pack Rat. The Shake and Bake was Pickney from Massachusetts, who came from some big deal family and wanted to launch his big career in politics or law with a glorious tour of duty. He saw the politicians' cheap promises on the war come and go in his Time magazines. After the Tet Offensive, he said it was hard for him to believe our leaders in Washington. Beach Boy from California always seemed to be catching a peek in his handheld mirror of that silky sheet of blonde hair that lay across his greasy forehead. Sandy was older and just got back from R&R in Hawaii, where he and his hometown girl got married. We teased him, saying even this woman couldn't make him smile. He'd bark at us new guys to stay flat on our bellies in firefights. John B. had something godly in his ordinary way. The older guys said he wasn't going to make it because he didn't really seem to care if he lived or died. He never killed, just ordered encountered enemy to chew hoy, surrender. Unbelievable. My spirits were lifted listening to John B. talking with a new guy, preacher's kid, who'd been in country just 2 weeks, fresh as Kansas corn, clear as a bell in his heart. The news went like a shock through all of us. Preacher's kid had been hit down by the stream. Huddling together, standing elbow to elbow, we pleaded with the new doc to save him. PK's eyes were closed, his legs twitching. A small entry wound right in the center of his forehead. The bullet exited, taking off the back of his head. Doc, who had so far only dealt with pimples, bug juice, and leeches, grimaced as he tried to make sense of the mass of blood, brain tissue, and splintered white bone fragments that glistened in the low setting sun. It was enough for me. I had too many days to go, so I just forgot time. I let myself become numb. I stepped outside myself. I had no wristwatch, just heat, suspense. Exhaustion spread over uncounted time. How can I tell it? Is there language? As the weeks passed, each of us held on to one special thing for meaning and sanity. Duke's was his huge radio pack. Beach Boy, his pretty face in the mirror. Pickney, his Time magazines. Me, my letters. John B., his God. Benson, his traded cans of fruit. Sandy, his wife and home in 2 months. The 2 and 3 tour guys toyed with their rage like scorpions they kept in jars. That evening, Friday, I remember because I was resting, imagining what Beth and I would have been doing on Friday evenings. The drive-in, movies, the beach. The feeling of having her body close to mine all came back. Ah! It was awful. We were hit by incoming B-40 rockets. The VC got the quadrants on our position. The next day, I don't think anyone cared if anyone lived. There was an NVA regiment somewhere in this jungle with us, and I was ordered to guard a trail alone. I felt cut off. As I lay prone on my belly, my senses tuned up, listening for a snapping twig, a scent of food seeping from some concealed underground bunker. My throat was dry. My mind began playing tricks after a while. Then my eyes saw some bushes slide slowly sideways. Carefully, silently, three armed NVA moved out from their hiding place in the bush and entered onto the trail. They were walking toward me. A November evening. My eyes opened wide, my stomach sank, I shook. I kept thinking, they're Americans, they're Americans. No, no. As they approached me, one looked directly at me. His eyes opened wide. Oh God, oh God. John B. held me by the forearms. Chow time. The guys kept telling me how I had alternated careful aim. One single burst to the first man's heart. How the other slouched and tried to grab his buddy. They said I was shaking and fired another six rounds into him as he tried to crawl away. But the third man got away. I fired 20 rounds all told. Guys in my squad searched the two bodies for papers and brought me a bloody hammock and a photo from the first man of his family, wife and kids. Photo small, but family large and happy. I didn't want any of these things. That night, never was I so alone while the others slept, as my night world filled with their faces, their fear, his cries as I kept firing. My wickedness, my fear, and his smiling family. Filled to the breaking point, I reached out repeatedly to a silent, starry night, my patient comforter. I saw before morning broke that God had gathered these men to me, and in each survivor there is a grave. They will always be with me, and I with them, sharing my laughter, my tears. They are my ancestors now. Dear Mom and Dad, it's pretty rough here, but I'm doing okay. I finally saw a little action. I handled it pretty well. It's still hot here. I think of you all and read your letters over many times. I hope we'll be together for a good old-time Thanksgiving this time next year. Your son, Virgil. Humping a click or two a few days later, a human skull bobbed on top of Beach Boy's backpack for hours in front of me. my crow, my conscience looking back. John B. was walking point and took two VC prisoners. He took them by surprise on the trail and offered them the chance to chew hoy, surrender their arms peacefully, which they did. Christmas, Christmas, oh, Jiminy Christmas. Beach Boy got on Santa's Christmas card chopper, and we watched him fly back to the world. But not before he asked me to take a photograph of his pretty face. I swear, if a bullet in Nan didn't kill Beach Boy, his first gray hair will. We had a real great time at LZ Grant. Hot shower. The first in 60 days. The Duke didn't take a shower. Phew. Didn't even change out of his filthy greens. He was losing his poise. I think we teased Duke too much at Chow. We were always patting his back to keep him happy carrying the radio pack so it wouldn't give a turn to any of us. We all knew, as the Duke was finding out, that VC snipers always go for the radio man first. As I watched him wising up to us, I felt some guilt. He was withdrawing from us, big time. Just 120 more days. We were conducting operations near the fish hook. We'd found a few criss-crossing paths that had heavy sandal traffic. Maybe 70 of us, company strength, reduced size, were walking slowly on a trail. We were tense, keenly tuned to every snapping twig, to the sour smell of human presence. I could feel my blood pulsating, my muscles tighten more. I took a deep breath. I looked at some of the other guys' faces and could see them thinking, this is the day. This was nonsense. Absurd to sweep this area. We were ordered to organize a small recon. The squad was to break off to the left. All hell broke loose. This was contact. We had run into the bunker complex of part of the 7th Battalion, 209th Regiment, 7th NVA Division, at 17:15 hours. Chinese claymores, B-40s, automatic weapons, Chi-coms. We tried to return small arms fire, but didn't even know where the enemy was. We scattered in utter confusion. I kept laying prone, pressing my body into the ground, shut down, unable to see or hear any support. No aerial support strikes, no Cobra gunships, no artillery. Bamboo shreds were snowing on Rosie and me from all the incoming rockets and gunfire. Rosie returned 60 machine gun fire when we spotted a sniper's nest and ground fortifications. They were mostly underground and dug in good. You could hear screams from medvac. No one was rallying. Once we started getting heavy volume artillery support, we were forced to retreat about 30 yards. The LT couldn't find the Duke. I volunteered to go out and find our communication. I heard the voice and squelch of his radio and found him. Duke was huddled, curled up in a wad. He'd let go of his radio pack. That was lying on the ground. I searched him. There was no blood.
It's okay.
I lifted the little Duke up in my arms and carried that little man-child back. He couldn't reply. He'd been scared and withdrawn too long. He'd lost it, his dignity. It don't mean nothing, Earl. The next day, we saw him loaded on a chopper with several body bags. I had lost the ability to cry. Back at the firebase, I saw the colonel, who had kept on asking us for an enemy body count. I looked at him hard. Yesterday's shame was in his eyes. Dear Dad, I realize now for myself what you already knew, that war brings out the brokenness in men and breaks them more. I'm so tired. I don't care anymore. Don't mean nothing. We are so worn down by the death of our men. I don't even remember when I was a boy. Folks back home just don't know. Your son, Virgil. I didn't have to tell Dad what we both knew about the 1,000-yard stare you get from having to watch seconds, hours, and days for mines underfoot and snipers overhead. Hyper alert, seeing everything at a glance, your mind racing at high speed. I couldn't count on my fingers and toes all the dead I've seen and smelled. Folks back home just don't know. I fell asleep where I was writing. Sunday, February 10th, 1970. I got up early. We were